Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ghost Hunting in New England.
Your favorite spooky podcast. Hi, everyone, and happy Wednesday. Welcome to Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
And, oh my gosh, Beth, I love our new intro music. I can't hear it enough.
I was actually thinking that I was going to make it the ringtone on my phone because, yes, I am so happy that Aaron did that for us. And I, like, walk around just kind of singing it in my head. It's so fun. Thank you, Aaron.
Yes, thank you to Aaron Schill down in Tennessee for making that really awesome intro for us. Thank you so much. So today, Beth, we're doing something really fun.
We are.
We have been kind of sticking to Massachusetts a little much lately, so we wanted to switch it up. And today we're going to go over some well-known ghost stories out of Rhode Island.
Because Rhode Island, as you may know, is the smallest of our New England states.
Is that why we picked it first? Is that why we picked it first?
I actually picked it first because I have this book that only has stories from Massachusetts and Rhode Island.
Okay, so Beth, you want to get us started with your first story?
Sure. So my first story is about nine men's misery, and I'm taking it primarily from a book called Ghost Stories and Urban Legends of New England, and it's by Deborah Cano, TJ Hero, and Mary Terrian, and I'll definitely put a link to it on the website. So the first story is as follows. So just to let you guys know, Amelia and I have not heard each other's stories before, so you're going to hear some pretty authentic reactions. And our hope is at the end we'll pick the story that was our favorite story and decide where we'll go do a ghost hunt in the very near future. During King Philip's War, Captain Michael Pierce led 60 Plymouth Colony colonial troops and 20 Wampanoag Christian Indians in pursuit of their enemies, the Narragansett Indians. The colonists were looking for revenge toward this group of Indians because they had recently burned several Rhode Island towns and attacked Plymouth as well. The retaliating troops caught up with the Narragansetts but were ambushed in what is now the city of Central Falls, Rhode Island. Pierce's troops fought for their lives for several hours, but in the end were defeated by a larger force of Narragansetts who surrounded them. Nearly all of the colonial troops, including Captain Pierce himself, were killed in the battle. 10 colonial soldiers escaped the original ambush, but 9 of them were soon captured and gruesomely tortured to death. These 9 men were flayed or skinned alive, and their heads were impaled with spikes and placed on display. The Indians then took the decapitated heads of the soldiers and jammed sticks into the corners of their mouths, and this action held their faces in a permanent grin to symbolize the smiling, lying white men that the Indians had quickly grown to hate. The 10th man who was lucky enough to have survived the bloody encounter was named Abbott. The path he took to escape the attacking Indians is now a road named Abbott's Run Valley Road. This road's name forever immortalizes Abbott's run for his life on that fateful day of March 26, 1676. The 9 mutilated corpses were found a day later by English soldiers who were on a military burial mission. The soldiers immediately buried the remains of the dead men on the exact spot on which they were found and then created a tomb of stones to memorialize the colonists. Because of the gruesome nature of the torture, indicated by the state of the bodies found by the burial mission, the site became known locally as the Nine Men's Misery. 3 days after Pierce's fight, the war escalated as the Indians proceeded to attack many more towns. The killing spree continued until Providence was essentially burned to the ground with hundreds of men, women, and children murdered. Also hit very hard was the city of Pawtucket. This unfortunate city, located in the middle of the war zone, had many, if not most, homes burned down and many people were savagely killed. The colonists retaliated by capturing and executed Canonche, the chief sachem of the Narragansett Indians. A few months later, King Philip himself was murdered. In 1790, a group of medical students led by a local physician, Dr. Bowen, disturbed Nine Men's Misery by digging up the bodies in an attempt to identify them. This group was especially eager to find the remains of an individual named Benjamin Bucklin, who allegedly took part in Pierce's fight. Even at the young age of 19, Benjamin was appointed to be one of the two town troopers of Rehoboth, who gave aid to the townspeople and kept order by force if necessary. Benjamin was an energetic and virtuous man with extraordinary height. These valuable characteristics contributed to his appointment to this position. Dr. Brown's group exhumed three of the skeletons before outraged locals stopped them from continuing, and results of the exhumation reveal that Benjamin Bucklin had apparently died at the age of 35 during the massacre of Nine Men's Misery. Factors considered for his identification were his remarkable height and by having what was described as an unusual set of double teeth all around. The site was desecrated several more times until 1928, when the monks who currently own this land that borders their monastery cemented the stones above the site, deterring future gravediggers. Eventually, this site was marked with a plaque by the Rhode Island Historical Society. For years, rumors have persisted that the area surrounding Nine Men's Misery is haunted. Of course, the fact that the unidentified remains were repeatedly dug up only adds fuel to these rumors. There have been reported sightings of dismembered bodies floating between the trees, apparitions of men digging up skeletons, and Indian ghosts prowling the unmarked paths of the monastery woods. If you're brave enough to venture into this densely wooded area, look very closely and you will find the massacre's site. Many say the men's agonizing cries and moans have not ceased over the years, and this may account for the police being called more than once to investigate reports of screams coming from the woods in the vicinity of the monument. Within these woods, several other gruesome deaths had occurred over the centuries, especially during the bloody days of King Philip's War. Paranormal investigators say their instrument readings are routinely high in the immediate area of the tomb, and many groups have succeeded in recording chilling electronic voice phenomena there as well. If you decide to see the monument for yourself, we dare you to hold your ear to the stone tomb and see if the locals' claims are true. Can you hear the victim's screams for mercy?
Nice. That's cool.
That is kind of a cool legend that goes back to the early settlers here in the region, and that it's lived on so long. In my research about it, additionally, on top of this, there isn't actually any evidence that the medical students or that Dr. Bowen ever existed or ever really dug up the grave. So that might just be an additional piece of the legend that's been carried on over the years.
Huh. All right. Do you know if any groups have gone out there recently?
I don't know if any groups have gone out there recently. I didn't see any, like, recent news on that particular story. But I definitely thought that it was an interesting one, in that it does talk about things that just happened so long ago in a time period here in New England that was like the Wild West became about 200 years later.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. It's interesting people are still seeing stuff over there. Very cool.
Yeah.
Where in Rhode Island is that?
Oh, we can find that in Cumberland, Rhode Island. It's actually right in the woods next to the public library. So it's Route 114, which is Diamond Hill Road in Cumberland, Rhode Island.
Cool. Very cool.
So I think that one would definitely be an easy one to find. I also, in my research about it, found that the path is pretty well marked. And so if we were to try to go out there, we would be able to find it easily.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool.
So it's a contender.
Yeah. Okay, so my story, which if you're listening to our podcast, I can almost promise, guarantee, you are somewhat familiar with the Perrin family haunting. And if you don't know it by that name, it was featured, they used it as inspiration for the movie The Conjuring, one of my favorite movies. So that's what we're going to do.
Bah, bah, bah.
It's a great movie. All right.
So this is like the true story behind the movie of The Conjuring?
Yeah. So The Conjuring, they took from, they used two different investigations that Ed and Lorraine Warren did.
Okay.
And this was the main one they used for The Conjuring.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to go over the real story.
Excellent.
Yes.
Talk slow.
I'll try.
Okay.
That's so hard for me. I'm a fast talker.
I'm going to cut that part out.
I'm a fast talker. All right. In January 1971, the Perrin family moved into a 14-room farmhouse. It's a big house. And it was called by the locals as the Old Erin Estates. And that is in Harrison, Rhode Island. So the family consisted of Carolyn, Roger, and their five daughters. And they began to notice strange things happening almost immediately. So it started out small. Carolyn, the mother, would notice that the broom went missing or seemed to be moved from one place to place on its own. She would hear the sounds of something scraping against the kettle in the kitchen when no one was in there. And she'd find small piles of dirt in the center of a newly cleaned kitchen floor.
That would really annoy me so much because I am like, if I went through and cleaned my whole house and there's a pile of dirt, somebody in my house would be getting yelled at.
So, yes. But also, that is very unsettling to me because I had someone reach out to me this week before I started researching this story. And it's for a haunted apartment in Brighton. And one of the things they said that has been happening is they find little piles of dirt on their bed. Like perfect piles. And trust me, I am very close to this couple. And Sarah is not the type of woman to have any kind of bed, like mess near her bed.
So one of the things that made me think of immediately was, did you ever go to Aunt Ruth's house in Houston?
No.
So Aunt Ruth's house in Houston had these wooden beams in the kitchen or in the living room. And she complained that like dirt kept falling out of it. Like she kept finding like little piles of dirt underneath them. Mm-hmm. It turned out there were some sort of like termite bug wood, like bugs in there. They were actually eating the wood and it was falling on the floor. So just an idea.
Okay. So Carolyn went and researched the history of the home after all this stuff started happening. She was a little spooked out and discovered it had been in the same family for 8 generations. So that's a really long time. And that many of the people who lived there died under mysterious or horrible circumstances. So
I'm wondering, would I rather die under mysterious or under horrible circumstances? I'm going to think about that a little.
I'd want to be mysterious because then I could end up on the ID channel because that's my favorite channel.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if I died in horrible circumstances, I could end up on like the major networks. I could be like a major movie.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, can nobody kill me in a horrible manner, please? Or a mysterious one.
Okay, so several of the children drowned in a nearby creek. One was murdered. So that actually, we're going to get to that a little later because there's some question on one or two or a couple children, but that's kind of besides the point at this point. So a few people had hanged themselves in the attic. And since we don't do demons on this show, there was a woman who lived in the home who some speculate became a demon, and I'm not going to use her full name because I am religious and superstitious. So we're going to call her Bess. Okay.
I'm sorry. We're going to call her Beth? Why are we going to do that?
No, Baths. B-A-T-H-S.
Baths?
It's the first part of her name.
Oh, that's a weird name.
Okay.
Can we call her like Kathy?
No. It turned out there was actually a real person named Bath Sherman who lived on the parents' property in the mid-1800s. She was rumored to have been a Satanist, and there was evidence that she had been involved in the death of a neighbor's child, although no trial ever took place. And Bath is said to have practiced witchcraft, sacrificing her own baby to the devil before hanging herself from a tree in the backyard. She was buried in a nearby Baptist cemetery in downtown Harrisville. So the cemetery is really close to the house. And I read there was this guy who did this like major, extremely well-investigated blog on this. And he has some issues with that part of the story. So the bodies weren't exhumed or anything. But his point was, you know, at the time period where Bass lived, if anyone suspected her of witchcraft, she wouldn't have been buried in the Baptist cemetery. And his other concern with it was all of her children were buried in the cemetery too. So if you're going to murder your child back then, I guess it might not have, or like sacrifice it to the devil, probably wouldn't have been buried in the Baptist cemetery. But I mean, you never know. You definitely never know. So the parents believed it was Beth's spirit that was tormenting them. Andrea, the pair's oldest child, said whoever the spirit was, she perceived herself to be the mistress of the house and she resented the competition my mother posed for that position. So this spirit went like crazy, specifically on the mother, but really on the entire family. And the house was also haunted by, they think, up to like 9 different spirits, because according to Andrea, the family experienced other spirits as well, and they smelled like rotting flesh and would cause the beds to rise off the floor. And we all know those famous scenes from that movie. She claimed her father would enter the basement and feel a cold, stinking presence behind him. They often stayed away from the dirt-floored cellar, but the heating equipment would often fail mysteriously, causing Roger to venture downstairs. And as we always talk about, a lot of times your equipment or electric stuff or anything in your house, if your house really is haunted, it will go totally haywire. So over the 10 years that the family's lived in the house, the Warrens made multiple trips to investigate. And if you don't know who the Warrens are, oh my gosh, you're missing out on so much fun. So Ed and Lorraine Warren are two of the most prominent American paranormal investigators of all time. Ed was a World War II veteran and a former police officer who turned into a leading demonologist. And Lorraine was a well-respected clairvoyant and medium. And Lorraine actually passed away last month, which is why I wanted to do this story, because she's always been so inspirational to me. I've watched a lot of documentaries on her. She's so cool, the way she handles spirits and cases and dealing with these entities and things that other people really don't want to deal with. It's very cool. And for a woman of her generation to be involved in this is pretty badass. It's pretty cool. So back to the story. At one point, Lorraine conducted a seance to attempt to contact the spirits that were possessing the family. During the seance, Carolyn Perron, the mother, became possessed, speaking in tongues and rising from the ground in her chair. "I thought I was going to pass out," said Andrea. "My mother begins to speak in a language not of this world and of a voice not of her own. She levitated and was thrown across the room." Though the movie version of events culminates with Ed performing an exorcism rather than a seance, Lorraine insists that she and her husband would never have attempted an exorcism, as they must be performed by Catholic priests. And for those who don't know, the Warrens are very Catholic. So after the seance, Roger, the father, kicked the Warrens out because he was worried about his wife's mental stability. Understandable.
Yeah, maybe her physical stability as well, as if she was just thrown across the room.
Understandable. So the oldest daughter, Andrea, insisted that the Warrens never drove away any ghosts, but actually just aggravated them. The Warrens tried to help, but we essentially found things got worse around them, which I think that's very interesting. So according to Andrea, the family continued to live in the house due to financial instability until they were able to move in 1980, at which point the spirits were silenced and the hauntings on the property ceased. But in Andrea Perron's 3-volume history on her family's haunting, which you can find anywhere books are sold, she reports a final twist, and that is many of the ghosts had grown attached to the family and came with them, haunting them all for years. Spooky.
Very. I guess when they left, they should have let the ghosts know that they were supposed to stay there in the house.
I don't know if those ghosts would have listened.
Yeah, that's frightening. How come they didn't follow the family that lived there before?
Because they were members of that family.
Oh, the parents are members of that same family?
No.
Did all of the previous family die? How did the parents come to own this house?
I don't know, but the people who died were part of that family that had been there for 8 generations.
Okay, yeah.
So that's why the spirits were upset the parents moved in, because they felt they owned the house.
Hmm.
Right.
And they were specifically mad at the mom. You know, moms get a bad rap. We don't do anything wrong. We're just trying to keep our family in our house. And this poor mom got apparently possessed by a demon and thrown across the room.
Hey, it happens.
I don't know. No, we're not going there.
All right. On to the next. What do you got next?
All right. So you say that one would be a fairly easy one to also go. And I don't know that we're not going to do demons, so we're not going to go and investigate that one, right?
Right.
So the next story that I have is, again, from that same book by Kano Hiro and Terrien. And this one is about a family similar to the parents, and it's called Footsteps in the Night. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
There. In the early 1960s, Theodore and Rose Beauchamp were a married couple struggling to make ends meet for their large family of eight. Theodore often worked two jobs outside the home, while Rose basically worked morning until night chasing after six children. Money was definitely tight at the Beauchamp home, and the kids often went without some of the luxuries their friends had. Money problems aside, the family was fortunate enough to be surrounded by lots of extended family. For several years, they lived in a three-bedroom rented tenement apartment that also housed relatives on the higher and lower floors of the same home. Their grandparents, along with several aunts, uncles, and cousins, also lived in an apartment home right next door. As comforting as it was to be surrounded by family, the houses were in bad shape and were located in a pretty run-down section of Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Inevitably, they received notice from their landlord that their rented home, as well as the entire block of homes surrounding it, were to be demolished and replaced with condos. The family was devastated by this news because they knew they were in for a real challenge trying to find affordable housing in a decent area for their children. As the days drifted by, the Beauchamp family watched with sadness as their extended family members moved away. Some were fortunate enough to purchase homes of their own, while others took up residence in other rented apartments. As the eviction date quickly approached, desperation was settling in for the Beauchamp family because, as of yet, they had no place to go. Calling the apartment rental ads in the newspaper proved to be a futile endeavor because it seemed no one wanted to rent their home to a family with six children. With one day to spare on the eviction deadline, Rose received a phone call from an elderly man who happened to have overheard a conversation about their family's eviction plight. The man introduced himself as Mr. Fogarty and explained that he and his wife owned a large home that had recently become available for rent. He gave Rose several positive details about the home, including a big kitchen, large fenced-in backyard, and the fact that it was located in a nice section of Pawtucket. Mr. Fogarty agreed to accept whatever their current rent payment was now if they would agree to be responsible for the upkeep of the home, including any repairs. Happily, the Beauchamp family agreed to these terms and was willing to live in this home sight unseen. Small pause. I get the sense with housing, I haven't had to look for any property in years and years, but I'm guessing that housing is a pretty tight commodity to come by.
What do you mean?
Like, if you're looking for a place to live, like, it's hard to find a place to live.
It's hard to find an affordable place to live.
It's hard to find an affordable place to live. And so if somebody called you and was like, hey, I heard you need a place, and I'll accept whatever you're paying for rent right now, would that set off alarm bells?
No, I would go for it.
You would?
Yes.
You're brave. I would be like, mm-mm, sounds like a Craigslist scam to me.
That is because you don't rent an apartment in Boston. It's a much different game out there right now.
Well, I guess, but yeah, I just like, as soon as I get to that part in the story, I'm like, oh, so happily they're going to go move to a house that they have never seen for very far below market rate. This is going to go great. Okay, back to the story. The following day, the family scrambled to pack up all of their belongings and headed to their new home. With great anticipation, the family frantically searched each home on their beautiful new street for the house number 78 that Mr. Fogarty gave them over the phone. Each house along the street was large and beautiful, and the family could hardly contain their excitement any longer until they saw it. It was large too, but not so beautiful. The first thing Theodore noticed was the fact that the house was in desperate need of a paint job. The oldest son, Ted Jr., who would be responsible for the yard work, was disappointed to see the large yard was covered in dirt and weeds where the grass should have been. Oldest daughter, Rachel, was immediately embarrassed about the creepy look of the home and wondered what her friends would think. Third-born child, Lena, said she hated the idea of living across the street from a cemetery, which they hadn't expected. The youngest in the family, Lisa, asked what the evil-looking statues along the roof edge were called, and Rose explained what gargoyles are and said she would like them taken down immediately. The twins, Dee and Richard, whined, asking why the parents were making them live in such a scary-looking house. With no other options available to them, the family began to move their possessions into the big old house. As instructed, they found the key in the mailbox. Even the key was creepy. It was a huge antique skeleton key.
Nice.
Theodore...
I have a tattoo of one of those.
Do you?
Yeah, on my ribs.
Theodore remembers commenting, "I don't think anything that old was even used anymore." As promised, the five bedrooms were large, but definitely lacked any form of hominess. In fact, each room in the house had a dark, ominous feel to it. No one wanted to be left alone in any of the rooms, even for a few minutes. The family recalls making excuses to cluster together whenever possible. Which is pretty impressive when you have a family of teenagers, that they're looking to be together with the rest of their family. That seems unusual.
I think it's great. That's what we need. More haunted homes, more family bonding.
More family bonding, but we don't necessarily all need the haunted homes.
I mean, whatever works. Whatever makes happen.
Okay. My oldest son is way too cool to be seen with us or talk to us anymore, so we miss him terribly. Despite the house's creepy aura, the parents tried to make the best of the situation and did what they could to create a secure, comfortable atmosphere. However, it seemed as though some type of dark force was always working against them. Frequently, the children would question why they have to live in this scary house and ask to move. Hoping to please the kids, the parents even tried bringing home pets on several different occasions. The house, it seemed, had other ideas, and every pet, no matter how young or healthy, always died a mysterious, unexplainable death shortly after coming to this home.
One of those kids is a serial killer.
I hadn't considered that as a possibility, but that seems...
Yeah.
Yeah.
As into ghosts as I am as into serial killers, so I have a keen eye.
Okay. And killing pets is usually a first step on the serial killer's journey.
Oh, every serial killer does it, yeah.
Every serial killer kills pets first?
Yeah, look it up.
Okay, I will.
Yeah.
Well, I won't. I'll take your word for it.
Okay. They also have, they have lower heartbeats than the rest of us.
They have lower heartbeats?
Mm-hmm. Or like slower heartbeats.
Really?
That's why I'll never be a serial killer, because I have an abnormally high heartbeat.
It's from smoking.
No, it's from being stressed out all the time. I'm neurotic. That's why.
When I quit smoking, my heartbeat came way down. Uh-huh. I'm down around like 85 beats a minute now.
I am at 97 down from 114.
Oh.
And I was in way better shape when I was at 114.
Back to the story. Here are some stories about those unexplainable pet deaths. Daughter Rachel was given a healthy, purebred Bichon Frise dog by a close friend.
She got a purebred Bichon Frise, but yet they are unable to have a regular house.
How am I supposed to say that?
Bichon Frise.
Bichon Frise.
Wait.
All right, I'm going to try it again. All right. Daughter Rachel was given a healthy, purebred Bichon Frise dog by a close friend, but within a week's time, something strange was affecting the dog. Periodically, he would act very erratically, foaming at the mouth while thrashing around on the floor. The dog's vet was surprised to diagnose him as having epileptic seizures, although before moving into this home, he was a perfectly healthy dog. The last dog to reside in the home also died a premature death when the cause of the dog's mange-like appearance was diagnosed as obsessive self-mutilation. The vet explained the dog suffered from some type of untreatable nervous condition and advised that he be humanely euthanized to end his suffering. Little Lisa was devastated when her two healthy rabbits were found dead on the same day with no visible signs of a cause of death. I mean, rabbits tend to die easily. They just kind of like...
I mean, if you... I'm not going to say what I was going to say. I'm still thinking serial killer.
You're still thinking serial killer?
Dogs are poisoned. Fine.
Okay.
Both of the things could be caused by poisoning a dog.
Okay.
And, yeah, I used to have rabbits growing up, and it's hard to tell with a rabbit. It's not like a person. Like,
right.
And they have a lot of fur. They're, like, floppy.
And I think that their hearts go very, very fast already. So if yes. if they're scared by something, or, you know, like maybe the dog was barking at them and they both yes. just died.
You don't know.
Right. Rabbits.
Or maybe one of the kids killed the rabbit.
Are we ruling out the parents?
It tends to present itself more in children and teenagers.
Okay.
Growing up, want to hear a story?
Yes.
It's gruesome. Growing up, there was a kid down the street and he killed his dog. With, like, antifreeze or something.
Yeah. On purpose?
Yes. Yes. And everyone knew it was the kid, and his parents were like, no, it's not
what
him.
What an asshole.
Oh, man, yeah. And the parents were like, no, it wasn't him. We don't know who did it, blah, blah, blah. And everyone was like, we know this kid did it. I used to babysit this kid. Yeah, he's crazy. And he had these lizards. And then he went and he burned down their other neighbor's barn.
Oh, my God.
And everyone was like, we know he did it. And the parents were like, no, we have an alibi. And everyone's like, no. And anyway, long story short, kid turns 18. What does he do? Gets into a fight with some kids from the next town over. Gets mad. Someone throws a lighter at his car. He runs over all their girlfriends.
All their girlfriends?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes. I told you. It was a gruesome story. And they all survived. They all survived. Thank God. Thank God they all survived.
I was going to. And where is this charming young gentleman now?
He's out now. This was,
he's out now?
This was like 10 years ago.
Oh, my God. I might have to look him up and make sure he doesn't live near me.
I know. I recently found his Facebook.
Ooh.
My brother was almost in that car. Yes, for real. But he had to go to track practice. So my dad always says, this whenever my friends are like looking for homes, my dad always says, you have to look at the communities where the that have the highest amount of after school activities. So that way your kids don't get into trouble, because that's what my dad always says. He says, had Wilton not gone to his after school activity, his life would be very different right now.
He would have been charged with running over some girls?
No, three of Will's friends were in the car when the crazy kid did that.
They were in the car that the crazy kid was driving?
Yes.
So your brother was friends with the crazy kid?
My brother was friends with the crazy kid's brother.
Ugh.
Yes. We're from a small town. Everyone's friends with everyone.
That's how small towns work.
I babysat the kid.
That's frightening.
Yes. We don't have to leave this all in. We can cut this.
Oh, no. We're keeping this in. Okay. Where were we? The rabbits. Lena. Back to the story. Lena, the cat lover, begged her parents to allow her to keep a stray she had found in the cellar. As a cat lover, I have a sense this is going to break my heart. It appears the cat had been sneaking into the cellar through a hole in the screen, and one night the family was awakened because the cat was crying very loudly. Lena searched the home for the cat and was horrified to find three small sacks of deformed kittens lying on the staircase.
That's awful.
Several days later, the cat viciously attacked Ted Jr. while he was napping on the family couch. Most years, the family regrettably went petless, but they never felt exactly alone either. Always.
Hold on. What kid? The cat attacked one of the kids?
Yes.
Which one?
Ted Jr.
That's the serial killer.
He doesn't seem to have liked pets. He didn't have any.
Oh, yeah.
So you think Ted Jr.?
I think he's the ghost.
You think he's the ghost?
I think it's not a ghost. I think it's everything I am hearing about this leads me more to think serial killer than it does to think ghost. So okay. Far.
So far.
I keep interrupting, so we're not even close to done with the story.
I think we're like halfway through.
All right.
Most years, the family regrettably went petless, but they never felt exactly alone either. Always, the house seemed to harbor an unwelcome evil guest who watched their every move from somewhere out of this dimension. The kids all referred to this entity as the bad man who doesn't want us here. Even Rose agreed on this point, recalling, I found the cellar to be especially scary. I had to go down to the cellar on a daily basis because that was where our washer and dryer were kept, and I always felt watched by something down there. One unforgettable trait of the home was a door in the bathroom that led to nowhere. That's right, a door in the bathroom that leads to nowhere.
Back to my other story. The house that had the barn that got burned down, they had a door that led to nowhere.
Really?
Yes.
It just like opened up onto a wall?
Just opened up into air. It was on the second floor of the house. Yeah.
What?
I know. I don't know.
So you live in a small, or you grew up in a small town that was fairly well-to-do.
Correct.
And so that makes me very suspicious. Why didn't the building inspector come by and be like, hey, that door, like, you gotta, like, board that door up. You can't have a door just opening from the second floor so that people are going to fall out and die.
I don't.
Or be injured.
I don't know. They were, the father was from Wales, which is how I knew Wales was country. And I think that, you know, they just like to be a little quirky.
Okay.
It's not like they didn't have money to board it up. They rebuilt like another $1 million barn. The kid burned it down.
Oh.
Anyway, moving on.
Doors to nowhere. One unforgettable trait of this home was a door in the bathroom that led to nowhere. The tapping and scratching sounds that emanated from behind this door frightened the family. One day, Theodore chiseled away the coats of paint, pried it open, and found a closet-sized opening with a depth of only about 3 inches. 3 inches. For some unknown reason, a workable door was built inside this bathroom, but seemed to serve no purpose at all. No explanation was ever found for the creepy sounds that continued to be heard behind this door. The most unsettling... and we haven't apparently even gotten to the most unsettling feature of this home yet. Which you seem to think is Ted Jr.
Yes.
Killing all the small
Correct.
Animals.
I do.
Okay. The most unsettling feature of this home was the notorious shadowy night visitor. Rachel, Lena, Dee, and Lisa have all suffered the same inexplicable terror of lying in bed and feeling the presence of the spectral intruder. Each encounter starts out the same way as you hear the heavy footsteps of a booted man walking toward your room. Immediately, your body freezes in place as you are trapped in a state of shock. Using every ounce of strength you have, you manage to close your eyes in terror as the heavy footsteps draw closer and stop at the foot of your bed. Somehow, even though your eyes are closed, you are enveloped with the ghost's presence and you sense what he looks like. All four of the girls have described this entity as a tall, scruffy-looking old-time soldier dressed in a dark, old-fashioned suit with large, heavy boots.
Hmm.
I feel like we keep going back to that first interview with Barry where we talked about these...
sleep paralysis.
Yeah. So, maybe all three of the girls are having... sleep paralysis, or four of the girls are having sleep paralysis, and I don't know. Why they'd all be describing the exact same figure is interesting.
What's the word I'm looking
for? Take your time. Editing's a thing.
Group hysteria.
Oh, group hysteria.
Group hysteria, it's a thing.
All right.
So if, like, one's like, oh, I saw this thing, and the other's like, oh, yeah, me too, and then they all start thinking they're seeing it.
Okay.
When really their brother's a serial killer? Yeah.
Well, but I do because I've had that happen to me too. And even though I never opened my eyes, like I knew exactly what that presence in my bedroom looked like. Mm. So I could go either way on this particular part. All right. One evening, Rose went up to bed early because she had a headache. She explains, as I climbed the stairway, I saw a shadowy figure at the top of the staircase. He was only visible for a second before vanishing before my eyes, but I will never forget his face. He had scraggly hair and a full beard and mustache and reeked of a foul, musty smell. But his eeriest feature of all were his hollow eyes. Needless to say, I let out a blood-curdling scream and practically flew back down the staircase to find my husband asleep in front of the television. You can only imagine the shock this family experienced when years later, Theodore uncovered an antique chest that was hidden behind a brick wall in the cellar. Inside the chest was a box containing several letters and photos dating back to the Civil War. It appears that an individual soldier wrote all of the letters, and some of the letters were very poetic and romantic, while others were quite demanding and abusive.
Isn't that how it always is?
No.
It's always both.
No.
Yeah, I think so.
My husband doesn't write letters, but he's...
That's what I mean.
Well... he does his best to be romantic, but he's never demanding or abusive.
That's...
he sends me little text messages that are like, hi.
No, if you've ever had an over-the-top romantic man, you know.
I think that Sean's perfectly over-the-top romantic.
Okay.
Some of the letters were very poetic and romantic, while others were quite demanding and abusive. The Beauchamp family shuddered in horror when this very familiar-looking picture was also pulled out of the concealed box.
Ooh, spooky.
Would you like to describe that picture?
For whatever reason, they blacked out the eyes. That's the first thing I see. It is a tall, medium-built man. He's got a nice-looking beard on him and really high boots. He has knee-high boots. And a big coat and a button-down shirt. And it looks like he's writing one of those love letters.
It does look like he's writing one of those love letters. And he appears to be sitting on, like, a rocky...
he's on a hill.
But it's definitely old-timey. It's definitely, like, Civil War-y.
Yes.
You're a photography person. Did they have this kind of photography for Civil War stuff?
They did, but it would have been very expensive. Yeah, the first photos came out of the Civil War.
Then it seems unusual that this random guy would have a picture of himself like that.
He would have had to sit still for quite some time to get that.
Maybe they just took it while he was writing his entire abusive and demanding letter.
While he looked off to the side.
What did you call that?
What?
The male gaze.
Yeah.
Or maybe because we can't see his eyes because they're blacked out, maybe he's actually looking directly at
the camera. You crack me up. The male gaze. Look it up. Educate yourselves on art history.
So anyway, this was in the Woodlawn section of Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Nice.
But it doesn't give an actual address, which is fair enough because I'm sure that the people that live there are not interested in people coming over and being like, hi, we want to see if the Civil War ghost is here in your house. Also, do you have a serial killer killing your pets?
I would think both of those would be a selling point. People love haunted houses.
We have very different ideas about what makes desirable real estate.
I'm not saying I would want to buy one. I'm saying it is a selling point. People want to buy haunted houses all the time. Say your house is haunted, worth $1 million.
What?
Yes. Yes. It's a nice house.
Well.
And that sounds like a, you know.
I do want to say that someone in my family, possibly my direct maternal relative, definitely owns a house that has a spirit in it. So maybe when she goes to sell that house, we'll put it in the listing and see what happens.
There you go.
Okay.
I think that's fair.
And we were the ones that found it.
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right. Onward and upward.
My story next is of a very famous Rhode Island landmark, and that is the Biltmore Hotel.
Excellent.
Yes. The Biltmore Hotel of Providence, Rhode Island has existed since 1922. It has been featured in multiple movies and has given inspiration to Stephen King and Robert Bloch for terrifying fictional accommodations such as the Overlook Hotel and the Bates Motel. Did you ever see the new TV show Bates Motel?
I did not. I've seen Psycho.
Yeah, I've seen Psycho, but I really liked the Bates Motel, and then it kind of started getting a little weird, and then I stopped watching it. I think it's still on TV, though. First two seasons are great.
Okay.
Check it out. Okay.
Sean and I are always looking for something new to binge watch.
Yeah, go binge watch Bates Motel.
Okay.
Okay. In 1918, Johann Lassie Weizenkopf, famously known to be an open Satanist. Now keep in mind that 1918, an open Satanist.
Now, can you please clarify the difference between an open Satanist and a closed Satanist?
Yes, that is people know about it versus people don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So he made the decision to finance the construction of the Biltmore Hotel. It was public knowledge that the building's purpose was to educate the New England community about Satanism. Why? I don't know. I hear, like, this story is so wild to me because in New England right now, up in Salem, we have the Satan world headquarters of the Satanic Church is in Salem right now. And it was, like, a huge deal when they moved in there.
Yeah, I can imagine that that would be.
This was, like, 3 years ago it moved in there.
I don't know too much about, in fact, I don't really know anything about Satanism. So I don't really know why people would need to be educated in it.
Because
I don't know anything about it. But why people would want to be educated in it. I mean, if you were raised in any sort of a Christian upbringing,
yeah,
you kind of got the basic rundown on Satan and Satanism.
Well, you know, I mean, I was raised Christian and I have a lot of knowledge about Wiccan, which is very different than Satanism, but a lot of people don't know that.
Okay.
And I didn't know that until I educated myself.
Okay.
Maybe people are just interested.
All right.
But I will, as I move on, we will find out the real reason.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so back in the story, the hotel was even designed with religious considerations. Now, these aren't what we think of as religious considerations, Beth. These are satanic religious considerations.
Fair enough.
So it includes a chicken coop on the roof to supply plentiful sacrifices for weekly rituals. Underground altars, including dug-out springs used in cleansing rituals, and the famous, I don't know how to say this, Bashanti? I think it's Bashanti. Dining room, which was home to a staff of nude waitresses, affectionately known as the Bachanetti girls. Risque! That is risky. Risky business.
I mean, now, like, the Hooters girls all have to have, like, mini shorts and, like, half a shirt on at least, right?
In Massachusetts, you have a full shirt.
You gotta have a full shirt?
You have a full t-shirt.
Oh. I clearly have not been in a Hooters.
But... I've never been in Hooters, but I know my health codes. Okay. So, mob affiliations guaranteed that some terrible events occurred at the Biltmore Hotel. It was a well-known and extremely popular speakeasy at the time. Because of what happened with the mob, mixed with satanic rituals, many believe that there are a lot of trapped spirits in the walls of the Biltmore. During those days, the hotel attracted many high-powered men and law and government officials to its underground concealed bar. During this time, multiple murders saw at least 6 police implicated in the crimes. Further murders, including the drowning of an 11-year-old prostitute. Awful. So awful.
There were so many sad things about that sentence.
But that was the worst one.
Yeah.
By far the worst one. Even a mayor and a governor were implicated in murder, as well as several sexual assault accusations. Legends state that all of these deaths resulted in hauntings, seeing the spirits of murder victims trapped within the Biltmore. Then, on October 24th, 1929, there was a stock market crash that resulted in an unknown financial worker throwing himself off the 14th floor of the hotel. The identity of the man still is unknown today, but he left behind a legacy, as he is the Biltmore's most cited ghost.
What do you mean he was unidentified? Couldn't they, like, pick him up after he hit the ground and be like, oh, it's Jimmy? Nobody knew who this guy was?
No, no one knew who he was.
That's weird.
Not really. A lot of people were throwing themselves off buildings, though.
Yeah, but people would, like, they would have found their families.
They didn't have the internet. They didn't have, like, phones.
Yeah, but he must have had a mom.
Yeah, but, you know.
And she would have gone, like, hey, my kid's missing.
Well, he jumped off the 14th floor, Beth.
Oh, maybe there wasn't too much of him left?
Maybe not too you much identifiable.
You should see the way Amelia's looking at me. Like, her eyes couldn't get much further open.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you know, you don't want to say it, but, you know.
He would have been pretty much smushed.
He was splattered.
Splat.
Though he left from the 14th floor, his apparition has been spotted throughout the hotel. Many guests in lower levels also claim to see a man's body suddenly plummet past their window, only to rush over and see no gruesome aftermath on the street below. Thank God. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Scary. In addition to the phantom falling man and the many murder victims roaming the haunted Biltmore Hotel, other reports of unexplained paranormal activity do exist. Around the witching hour, many have claimed to hear the sounds of crazed parties coming from empty rooms. This includes the sounds of heavy stomping, as if drunken groups of dancers are taking the floor and glasses clinking from long past toasts. Others have heard and even cited apparitions of ghostly dancers gliding across the hotel's grand ballroom. So, if you want to stay a night at Providence's most haunted attraction, the Biltmore Hotel is located at 11 Dorrance Street in Providence, Rhode Island. And I looked it up, rooms start around $200 a night.
We could swing $200 a night.
It definitely swing $200 a night.
Especially if somebody sponsored us to go and stay there and do a hunt for $200 a night.
Okay. Cool stories, Beth.
Definitely, definitely interesting stories. So, I guess we don't do demons, so we're not going to the parents' house. And the Woodlawn section, Footsteps in the Night story, that doesn't give us an actual place to go to. So we have to decide, do we want to go to the Nine Men's Misery, which would be free, or do we want to go spend $200 to go to the Biltmore Hotel?
Biltmore Hotel, Biltmore Hotel, zero question in my mind. Definitely want to go to that one. It sounds way more haunted.
It definitely does sound haunted.
And I don't want to be, like, in Rhode Island late at night. No offense to our Rhode Island listeners. No, but you know what I mean? Like, out in the woods at, like, 3 a.m. in Rhode Island?
The path is marked.
Biltmore, 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 Biltmore.
Will you pay for room service?
No. They're not going to have anything vegan on the menu, and you don't drink.
This is true.
I know a lot of really, really good restaurants down in Providence.
Really good rest. Sean, will you be mad at me if I go spend $200 to spend a night at a ghost hunting hotel?
You'll only be spending $100.
Plus dinner.
Okay. I want to go to that one.
Apparently, folks, we are going to the Biltmore Hotel.
There we go. Yay, Biltmore!
So I guess look forward to an episode about our night at the Biltmore.
Yes, ghost hunting in Rhode Island.
So Ghost Hunting in New England, Rhode Island edition?
Sure.
Okay, cool.
All right, do we have anything else to talk about?
We do. We got some more reviews this week. So we wanted to give shout outs to the people who went on and took the time to write a positive review for us.
Okay, the first one comes from Barry. Ghastly fun! Amelia and Beth do a great job covering the many hauntings, stories, and legends in the New England area. They are knowledgeable, funny, and engaging. Do yourself a favor and subscribe. You'll be hooked, like me. Thanks, Barry. That was great.
Thanks, Barry.
Next is from KWill 722. Great podcast. Really interesting to hear about the ghost stories in New England, most of which I had not heard before. Thanks, KWill 722. That was really nice of you.
Thanks, KWill.
We actually got a lot of ratings this week. Next from L. Hughes 42. Love it. Easy listening, great stories. I'm hooked.
We're getting a lot of people hooked. Is that a bad thing?
Megan Ryan, 7690. Wow. Was recommended to this podcast by a friend. Definitely a fun listen. I'm skeptical about ghosts, but still have been enjoying listening to every podcast. Yay.
Thanks, Megan and Megan's friend. Well, we're skeptical sometimes, too, as you could tell from tonight's episode where Amelia thinks that there's a serial killer, not a ghost in the house.
Yes. Much like at my apartment late at night where I always think there's a serial killer here and something.
You think this is a serial killer? It's just
no,
your
not
cat.
Really. I know it's my cat.
Your cat might be a serial killer.
My cat's pretty mean. My cat's really mean. Okay, well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. I hope you have a really great week. I hope we have a great week, too. Beth, you want to tell them where we can find us?
Sure.
Where they can find us?
You can, here goes all the contact information. You can find us on Instagram at Ghost Hunting in New England. You can find us on Facebook at Ghost Hunting in New England. You can find us on Twitter at Ghost Hunting NE. You can visit us on our website, www.ghosthuntinginnewengland.com. Or you can email us, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. And as always, a big thanks to Aaron Schilb for doing the music for us, which we are really, really loving. You can reach him on Instagram at TheAaronSchilb.
Yeah, and be sure to check out his new band, The Dirt Road Degenerates.
Anything else going on that we need to shout out?
I got nothing.
Did you see that we got followed by Boston Donut Fest?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll go.
I'm going to be keeping an eye on them.
Let's go. Don't forget to subscribe online at iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. If you don't think we deserve a 5-star rating, please send us a message telling us what we can do to make your listening experience even better.
And please don't leave us a 1-star rating.
No, don't do that. That's
please
so weird.
Don't. No. And when you go into a restaurant with kids, clean up the floor. Don't leave that mess on the floor for the waitress.
And not even on the floor. Just like, even if you just like take all the paper towels and like put them, or like napkins, put them on one plate so that way they're not like picking up food and stuff. Like that's, come on.
Right.
Come on. What are you doing? Bye. All right. Bye, guys. Have a great week and
happy hunting.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.